Chapter 3. The world was still reverberating with the attack on the Brussels airport when Véronique underwent her second surgery, and then her third, and a fourth. She had held up so far, and after the third surgery, her internal organs were less compromised. The areas near her arteries had been cleared, her liver had suffered the greatest damage but could regenerate in time. The wounds on her body were deep, but she had lost no limbs, unlike many of the victims, both in Brussels and in Paris, who had lost arms and legs and hands and feet, either in the blast or from gangrene in the days immediately after. Marie-Hélène's law partner continued to get daily reports, which were not encouraging. Marie-Hélène's remains were in a military morgue in Brussels, with so many others waiting for instructions from the families. Bernard did not want to make any decisions about Marie-Hélène's interment until Véronique was conscious and could make those decisions herself, if she was alive to do so. And if not, he would bury them together. In June, 3 months almost to the day after the bomb explosion at Zaventem Airport, the surgeons at the military hospital made the decision to take Véronique out of the medically induced coma, take her off the respirator, and let her breathe on her own. She was very foggy at first, and didn't understand where she was, or why she was there, and by the next day she remembered the blast and where they had been going. She was still in ICU, where she could be observed by a team of nurses, with immediate help available if she suffered an unexpected complication, which was still a possibility. She wasn't fully out of the woods yet, and wouldn't be for some time. One of the nurses came to move her in her bed, and Véronique looked at her with wide eyes, her face still heavily bandaged. She looked like a mummy, with the bandages covering her head as well, and an eye patch over her injured eye. They had saved the eye in one of her many surgeries, but did not know yet if she would lose her sight in it. "How's my mother?" she whispered to the nurse, who was gently shifting her position. She had not been out of bed in 3 months, and was even thinner, and light as a feather. The one eye she could see out of looked anxious, as the nurse said something reassuring, and called the doctor when she left Véronique's cubicle. This was the moment they had already discussed with a team of psychiatrists. A psychiatrist appeared in her room an hour later. She was a woman in her early 50s. She had a motherly style with her patients. They had been facing new challenges with more than 100 civilian patients to deal with, which was very different from treating war-torn soldiers, injured in military action. "How are you feeling, Véronique?" the psychiatrist asked her. She nodded and didn't answer. She hadn't talked in a long time. Her voice was a croak when she tried to speak, and her throat still felt raw from the respirator. "Are you in pain?" the doctor asked her, and she shook her head. Her hands were bandaged too, from the wounds she had sustained on her hands and arms. "How is my mother?" she asked again. It was the most pressing question on her mind. The doctor looked at her quietly, and as gently as possible explained that Marie-Hélène had not survived the bomb. Véronique began gasping for air as soon as she said it. She couldn't breathe and couldn't speak. The psychiatrist stayed with her, speaking calmly to her for 2 hours, and they finally sedated her. It was a fact that had to be faced, and they thought she was well enough to hear it now. But they had no way of knowing how close Véronique had been to her mother, and all that she meant to her. Bernard Aubert came from Paris the next day, and they cried together. Véronique couldn't believe what had happened. She was willing to have sustained all the damage she had, if only her mother was still alive. Véronique couldn't imagine her life without her. She was decimated by grief. She was able to speak in a stronger voice by the next day. "And Cyril?" she asked Bernard, and he looked blank. "Cyril Buxton. He was with us. He's a friend of mine. He spent the night with us in Brussels, and he was flying back to London as soon as we took off. He was standing with us when it happened." She faltered on the last word, and couldn't make herself say the word bomb. I don't know, he said. I'll look into it. I didn't know anyone else was with you. He was surprised. After he left her, he checked the official list of casualties they had at the hospital and found that Cyril was on it. When he inquired, he was told that, like Véronique's mother, he had died in the initial explosion. His family had already claimed his remains. Bernard spent the night in Brussels and told Véronique the next morning. She was shocked and saddened, and couldn't understand why she had survived and they hadn't. Bernard explained it as the hand of destiny, not having any better answer. She was deeply depressed about all of it, understandably, especially her mother, but she was sad about Cyril too. He was such a sweet, innocent, fun-loving boy, and didn't deserve to have his life cut short. None of them did, and she felt terrible for his parents, losing their only child. He was 27 years old, she said to Bernard. He looked a dozen years older since his law partner had died. He brought up the painful subject of what to do with Marie-Hélène's body. A decision had to be made. Sobbing, Véronique decided to have her cremated and have the ashes sent to Paris. Bernard promised to keep them until Véronique came home and they could make arrangements for a memorial service then. It made it all seem even more final. Véronique cried for hours after he left. She was crying for Cyril now, too. 2 days later, Véronique was back in surgery, on her face this time, for the first of many reconstructive surgeries. Bernard had supplied the photographs they asked for. Marie-Hélène's office was full of framed photographs of her beautiful daughter. He sent them directly to the plastic surgeon, who sat staring at them for a long time before the day of the surgery. He had been given an impossible task to restore Véronique to anything like she had looked before the explosion. There was no way he could even come close, and they had not yet told Véronique how extensive her injuries were, or how her face had been altered, and she couldn't see it under the heavy bandages. He had made meticulous drawings and diagrams of what he had to repair and how to go about it, and he stood studying her carefully for a long time as she lay on the operating table, once she'd been anaesthetized. The surgeon assisting him looked at her too, and the two physicians exchanged a long glance. "It would be a fascinating challenge if it weren't so tragic," the senior surgeon said quietly to his colleague. "It's as though someone drew a line down the center of her face, destroyed one half and left the other intact." The wounds on one side had been superficial and had healed in the past 3 months under the bandages. The other half was unrecognizable for the moment, but even once it was repaired, the surgeon recognized that there would be two or possibly three deep scars intersecting her face. There would be no way to remove them entirely. He studied her photographs again and began the surgery. It was painstaking, minute work, and he was satisfied after 8 hours in surgery that they had done as much as they could for the moment. They bandaged her face again, and she was moved to the recovery room, as the assisting surgeon stayed to talk to him. "What do you think?" he asked him. The chief surgeon was one of their best, and had performed some near miracles in the past, but he wasn't a magician. "We can only do what we can. I'm going to try everything we're able to do, but it would take a miracle. The scars are too deep." Half her face had been destroyed by shrapnel. "I don't know how the other side remained so untouched. It must have been the angle at which she was standing when it happened, or some odd quirk of fate." "You know who she is, don't you?" his colleague asked, and the chief surgeon nodded. "I didn't at first, but I realized when I saw the photographs they sent me, and I did some research. She's one of the biggest models in the world, or she was until now. She's incredibly beautiful. It really is unbelievably cruel to see what happened." "When are you going to tell her?" he asked him. "When I have to, and when we've done some more repair work on the worst of it. She knows there was damage to her face. She just doesn't know how long-term it is. She hasn't asked much about it, but she hasn't been awake for long, and she's been more concerned about her mother, who died when it happened. but eventually this is going to be a big issue for her. Her modelling days are over, and if that was integral to her identity, and I assume it must have been, we're going to have a big problem. It's a very big deal to be an extraordinary beauty at one moment and then sustain this kind of damage. Her whole self-image will be shattered. Who she is, what she does, how she sees herself, how others see her, her whole career. This will be an enormous crisis for her. She'll have to rebuild her whole personality and identification system, not just her face. "Do you know anything else about her?" the assistant surgeon asked him. They were up against a huge challenge, and were still talking about it as they left the operating room. They both felt drained after 8 hours of surgery, and they felt great compassion for her, especially at her age, and seemingly with no one to support her. "Very little," the chief surgeon answered. "The only contact is her mother's legal partner, and he hasn't told me much about her, other than that she has no relatives. He sent the photographs, and no further information. The photographs speak for themselves. She's an incredible beauty, and one of the biggest models in the world. What else is there to say?" "It would help to know something about her character, how strong she is. She just lost her mother. That will be hard enough, and apparently there was a friend with them who died too. Now her whole identity is altered." "But at least she's alive," the assistant reminded him. "Sometimes that's not enough. I don't consider myself a vain man, but I'm not sure how well I'd do if I lost half my face." "The structure is still there. It's all the soft tissue that's the problem. At least the bone structure of her face is repairable." "It's the rest I'm worried about, and she will be too. It will take a lot of guts to deal with something like this." They were both still troubled by it when they left each other after the surgery, and the head surgeon took the before and after photographs home with him that night to study them some more and try to decide what to repair in the next surgery. They had a long road ahead of them, and so did she. And she had the trauma to deal with as well. Véronique asked very few questions after the surgery, and Dr. Moreau, the chief surgeon, wondered if she was afraid to. It was as though her mind didn't want to go there, and he decided that maybe it was just as well for now. But she couldn't hide from it forever. One day she would be back in a world full of mirrors and would have to deal with people's reactions to how she looked. On the other hand, they had seen patients who had lost all four limbs, which might be even harder. She would be able to lead a normal life. She just wouldn't look the way she looked before. But that was huge, particularly after all the adulation of being a model. Her beauty had been a given before, and now it had been stolen from her. The whole team was aware of what she would be facing, and they got a taste of the reality that would confront her once she left the hospital. There was no way of knowing who did it, but in July a story ran in a minor British tabloid saying that her face had been destroyed in the attack, and her career was over. Miraculously, no one else picked it up or believed it, like saying she had an affair with an alien. The tabloid that ran it was known for its lack of credibility and untruths. But it was also obvious that someone at the hospital had been paid for the story. No one outside the hospital knew about her face. Bernard was furious about it, and the head of the hospital apologized and promised to be more vigilant. At Bernard's request, she never saw it. She was cut off from the world without a computer, and wasn't reading the newspapers, magazines, or even watching TV. But it gave the whole medical team a foretaste of what would happen when she went back to Paris. Paparazzi chasing her, ordinary people taking photographs of her with their cell phones. Overnight she would become a freak and a victim of people's curiosity and baser instincts. Véronique didn't even have a cell phone at the hospital and didn't want one. Hers had disappeared in the explosion. She was still too sick to care, and she said that, without her mother, there was no one she wanted to call. She didn't need to call her agent, since she couldn't work, and Bernard had notified them she'd be off for a while, without further explanation. She was also in deep mourning for her mother, so she didn't want to talk to friends and other models. She had nothing to say. Her grief was all-encompassing, and with no contact with the world, she was safe for now. But it wouldn't last. Her half-damaged face would identify her as a victim forever. They were going to suggest to her that she wear a surgical mask when she went home, and use it whenever she went out. At least until the surgeries on her face were complete. And maybe even forever, if she couldn't deal with the inevitable stares and comments. Véronique never saw the second-rate British tabloid magazine with her photo on the cover. The photograph had been torn in half lengthwise, so all she had was half a face, and inside the magazine was the whole story of the explosion, and that she had been in it. Véronique would have hated the story. It made her an object of pity, but fortunately she never knew about it, and was spared the humiliation of public exposure. The day would come when she'd have to know the truth, that half her face had been ruined, and the other half was a cruel reminder of what it once had been. The summer went by slowly and painfully for her. Doctors and nurses came and went on vacation. She was still in the hospital, with assorted aches and pains resulting from her wounds, and she had another operation every 2 weeks. She'd have 4 more by the end of the summer. The plastic surgeon wasn't satisfied with the results, and she healed slowly, which made it harder to see progress. Her face had improved slightly, but not enough. She still hadn't seen it yet herself, and had no idea how far they'd come. The bone structure in her face was aligned again, but much of the tissue over it was deeply damaged. She had no distractions, and couldn't read easily with the injury to her eye. Her good eye functioned, but tired quickly. She thought about her mother all summer, and the positive things she would have said to get her through a terrible experience like this. She was thinking about that when Bernard came to see her one day. He was leaving the next day for his summer vacation, which he spent in Brittany every year. He felt that it was time to share her mother's will with her, and there were things she needed to know about Marie-Hélène's estate. He had warned her that he was going to bring it with him. She was dreading it. It made her mother's death all the more real. Véronique thought about it every day anyway, and about Cyril, and the horrifying circumstances in which they'd died. She wanted to write to his parents, but hadn't been able to make herself do it yet. Since he was an only child, she could just imagine how hard it had hit his parents. She wondered if they blamed her, because she had been with him at the time. She felt guilty herself, because she was alive and he wasn't. Although being alive was a question of degree at the moment, she still felt dead inside. And at times, she wished that she had died too in the explosion. The psychiatrist came to see her almost every day to talk about it. She felt like a prisoner now. All the medical staff was leaving on summer vacation, like the rest of Europe, and she was still in the hospital enduring surgery after surgery. The terrorists had committed the crime, and she and the other victims were being punished for it. She wanted to go home, but she was afraid to, and she knew it would break her heart to walk into her mother's apartment and find her not there, in the home where Véronique had grown up. In her fantasies, sometimes, she told herself that her mother was in Paris, and she would see her when she went home. And then the truth would come crashing down on her like the airport roof caving in on her again. It was becoming harder and harder to escape the truth. When Bernard came to see her, he was carrying a very large manila envelope, and he spread the contents out on Véronique's hospital bed. She had been moved to her own room by then, and was no longer in ICU. It was actually lonelier being in a single room. She didn't see all the activity of the intensive care ward and the people in it, and lay lost in her own thoughts most of the time. The psychiatrist thought she needed quiet time to process what she had to deal with. She believed that she still needed reconstructive surgery on her face, but she didn't yet know that little could be done to restore her. She no longer had the strong support of her mother, nor the distraction of the successful career she was used to. Everything in her life had changed, more than she even knew. Bernard had brought a copy of her mother's will, which was not surprising. She left everything to Véronique, including her apartment in the 17th, which is Véronique's now. It was not luxurious, but it represented a solid investment and a tangible asset with some value. She had few other possessions, but he had brought her bank statements as well, which were a big surprise to Véronique, and had been to Bernard too. There was a bank account, which a cover letter in the will explained had been left to Véronique by her father, for her support and education well into the future. And instead of using it for that purpose, Marie-Hélène had preserved all of it, invested it wisely, and supported Véronique herself from what she earned in her successful law practice. Véronique's father had left her $1 million, which astounded her. Marie-Hélène had less than that put aside herself from her earnings over the years and the value of the apartment, and in a separate account, Marie-Hélène had put the money that Véronique had earned as a model right from the beginning, which was just over $2 million. She had invested that well too, and it had grown considerably. So between her father, her mother, and the money she had earned herself, she had well over $3 million, closer to four, as well as her mother's apartment. And she had her own apartment to sell too. She didn't need two apartments. Selling her mother's apartment seemed like a sacrilege, and she wouldn't do it. She had decided to move back in and sell her own small apartment in the 7th. She had more than enough money to live well on. Thanks to her father, her mother's careful management, and her own hard work, she was very well set, and what her mother had left her in money and real estate was icing on the cake. There was a large manila envelope of photographs of Marie-Hélène with Véronique's father, and a number of him holding Véronique when she was a baby. There were many framed at the apartment, but dozens more in the envelope, with Marie-Hélène beaming beside him, which Véronique was happy to have, as an illustration of her history, and tangible proof that she had had a father. She looked very much like him, which Marie-Hélène had always said, and the money she had left in various guises was a real windfall. His name was Bill Smith, and she felt like such an orphan now. She wondered if she should change her last name to Véronique Vincent Smith, to honour both her late mother and her father. It was something to think about. Other than the financial statements, which were very neat and well organised, there was a letter in a sealed envelope. Reading it would be like getting a message from her mother from the grave. It seemed morbid and intimidating, and yet she was hungry to read it, and hear from her mother one last time. She wondered when she had written it and what it would say. Her mother had no deep secrets to reveal that she knew of. She led a quiet, transparent life, so Véronique assumed that it was just a tender goodbye, written long in advance, perhaps at an emotional moment. It would be hard to read, but she was eager for it, and decided to read it after Bernard left, so she could savour it when she was alone, and cry if she needed to. She put the sealed envelope on the table next to her hospital bed to read when he was gone. She put the rest back in the envelope, thanked Bernard for bringing it, and slipped it into a drawer in the night table so it was near at hand. He stayed for another hour, chatting with her, and it was nice to have company. He was her only visitor. She wished him a good vacation when he finally stood up to go. She lay quietly in bed for a long time afterward, trying to get up the courage to open her mother's letter. She couldn't imagine what was in it. She missed her mother more than ever. It was a physical pain that never left her, worse than her wounds from the shrapnel. Chapter 4. Véronique saw, as soon as she opened her mother's letter, that it had been written a year before, on her 21st birthday. In her mother's neat, careful hand, she had said that now that Véronique was an adult, she felt she owed it to Véronique to tell her the truth about her father, and she planned to do so, at an appropriate time, or after her death, if she hadn't told her yet, which was the case, as it turned out. A shiver ran up her spine as she read the words. The truth about her father. What truth was there to know, other than what her mother had already told her? She reiterated what Véronique already knew, that he was American and an attorney. He had been 61 when she was born, the same year he died, and they hadn't been married. But in the letter, her mother stunned her with two important details. The reason they hadn't married was that he already was, to someone else, with three children from that marriage. He had wanted to divorce his wife for years, and especially once he met Marie-Hélène. But he had had powerful political aspirations, possibly even a shot at the presidency. In fact, Marie-Hélène explained, he had run as a vice presidential candidate, lost the election with his running mate, and had subsequently become a senator. But a scandal, having an affair as a married man, with a love child and a mistress in France, would have ruined him if it had come out, and destroyed his dreams of politics forever. He had spent a considerable amount of time with Marie-Hélène in France, and loved it there, and he had been present at Véronique's birth and stayed for a month after. But in the end, Marie-Hélène confessed in the letter that she had stepped aside so as not to stand in his way and hurt his chances politically. She had ended their relationship, so he could pursue his dreams. What shocked Véronique was that he had let her. The letter went on to say that he had provided a large amount of money for Véronique's future to ensure her safety, education, and comfort. He and Marie-Hélène had only seen each other once after that, in a secret meeting, but remained in occasional contact. She assumed that Véronique knew about the money by then, since her instructions to Bernard as her executor were that neither the money nor the letter was to be revealed to Véronique until after her mother's death, just as he had done. He had no knowledge of the contents of the letter, only the financial arrangements, as executor. The shocker was that Bill had not died when Véronique was an infant. Marie-Hélène had left him for his sake and had made the ultimate sacrifice herself of her own happiness and well-being to honour his political dreams. It struck Véronique that he must have been a selfish man to let her mother do that, and heartless to leave them both. The money he had left their daughter was the reward for Marie-Hélène's being entirely selfless. They had agreed to tell Véronique that he had died, when during all this time he was very much alive. Véronique didn't know if he still was. Given his age at her birth, he would be 83 now, but he had been alive when Marie-Hélène wrote the letter a year earlier. He was still a senator at the time, although she knew he suffered from ill health and was planning to retire. His real name was William Hayes, and he had never tried to see his daughter, although Marie-Hélène said he inquired about her from time to time, and never lost touch. As soon as Véronique read his name, it sounded familiar to her, and she realized why he also looked familiar in the photographs. She had seen pictures of him somewhere, maybe in the press. So he had had the successful political career he wanted so badly, and Marie-Hélène had lost the man she loved and Véronique a father. She didn't like the fact that her mother had been deceptive about it, but it was hard to be angry at her now that she was gone. She had sacrificed so much for his well-being, because she loved him. If anything, Véronique was more touched than angry, and had never lacked for anything, thanks to her mother. The money he had left her had been untouched, to be used later on. He had given it to Marie-Hélène when they parted, so that it didn't become entangled in a legal battle at his death, and by giving it early he had spared everyone embarrassment. Marie-Hélène said that his wife had never known about her. It explained why they had never married, and she affirmed that he had been the love of her life. Véronique thought she had paid a high price for it, and there were tears running down her cheeks as she read the letter. More than anything, she felt sorry for her mother, who had given up so much, and she had been such a devoted, loving mother. The letter created a dilemma for Véronique. She was no longer an orphan now, as she had thought. She had lost her mother, but her father was alive. The temptation was great to try and see him, so that she had a connection with someone in the world and wasn't entirely alone. She hated what he had done to her mother, and how selfish he had been. But he was still her father, and she was curious about him. She had no idea how to reach out to him, and wanted to think about it. She was grateful her mother had written the letter, and realized it must have been painful for her. She apologized to Véronique for lying to her, but Véronique was mature enough to understand and forgive her for it. The one she had more trouble forgiving was her father, for letting her mother slip away and abandoning them both. She thought he had a right to know that her mother had died, which seemed like another valid reason to contact him. She was sorely tempted to do so. She wondered if he'd even respond. It gave her something to think about, other than her injuries and her own uncertain future. The only gift after all her losses was knowing that she had a father, and he was alive. She read the letter several times again that night, and looked at the photographs of Bill Hayes and her mother. Her parents. She wondered what kind of man he was, cheating on his wife with a mistress and having a child with her, and then abandoning them in favour of his political career. If nothing else, he sounded very selfish. She spent the rest of July and all of August thinking about it between her surgeries. She was due to be released in September. If her father had health problems, she wanted to meet him before he died. She had a lot to think about now that she knew about him, and she was grateful for her mother's letter, and the truth at last. Things seemed very slow at the hospital in July and August, with many of the doctors away for their summer holidays. She had two more surgeries to remove more shrapnel in July, and another long plastic surgery on her face and a shorter one in August. She had been in the hospital for 5 months by then, and had improved enough to start feeling restless and cooped up. She still had odd, inexplicable aches and pains from the shrapnel throughout her body, and was told she'd have to live with it. She could see shapes and light and dark with her injured eye now, which they said might not improve. Technically, she could drive with an eye patch, but she didn't feel safe driving with impaired vision, whether legal or not. She still needed another surgery in a few months, but the ones in August were the last ones for now. She wondered how long it would take so one couldn't see the scars. She knew that plastic surgeons could perform miracles. When the bandages came off in early September, she got her first glimpse of the truth. She had two deep scars that ran across the right side of her face, and a third, smaller one below it. They said there would be some improvement, and they would pale, but they couldn't be fully erased. She just stared at them in the mirror and cried. Half her face was untouched, and the other half badly scarred. The reality was shocking when she saw it. She almost fainted when she first saw the injured side in contrast to the unscarred half of her face. It looked like a bad before and after photo. She realized then that this was her face now, half perfect and half damaged, like a terrible curse someone had put on her. The psychiatrist spent hours with her while she cried. She tried walking around the hospital in the surgical mask they gave her to conceal her scars, and felt smothered and like an invalid. When she got back to her room, she stood in front of the mirror again, crying, and refused to talk to the psychiatrist the next day. She was tired of all the doctors and nurses, the bandages, the smell of the hospital, the pain after each surgery, and the terrifying sight her face had become. How could she see anyone or leave her house? She would have to wear the face mask forever. The surgeon said the scar would become less vivid in a few months, and the smaller scars would disappear. But the three deepest ones could not be repaired more than they were. She had disappeared from her life after the explosion, and had seen no one except Bernard Aubert. But how would she go back now? And she didn't have her mother to lean on. She wanted to run away and hide. But wherever she went, her half-ruined face would be with her. She couldn't imagine facing anyone with it, or leading a normal life again. Not only was her career over, but all semblance of a life. She was sitting in her room, contemplating her future, and the prospect seemed grim, when the phone rang. She assumed it was Bernard, since he was the only one who called her. No further information had been given to her modelling agency, other than that she had been at the Brussels airport and couldn't work for several months, and there was no work anyway in the summer, so they hadn't called. She had turned off the phone in her hospital room, and hardly turned it on in 5 months. Many people had written to her about her mother, and she hadn't had the energy yet to answer them, although she had been touched by their messages when Bernard forwarded them to her. Many of them were unaware that Véronique had been injured, and she had no desire to explain it to them, especially now. Bernard's secretary picked up the mail at the apartment every week, paid the bills, and sent the rest to her. She picked up the phone in her room, expecting to hear Bernard's voice, and instead a young female voice said a cautious hello.
"Véro, is that you?"
It took her a minute to place it, and then realized it was Gabriella Foch, a girl she had gone to school with, who had moved to Brussels with her parents 5 years before. She was startled to hear her voice.
"Gabriella?"
"Yes. I was just reading in a Belgian magazine about the attack on Zaventem, and I saw your picture. There was a whole page of little photos, the size of postage stamps, of all the victims, and there was one of you, and I read your name. I couldn't believe it. I'm so sorry about your mum."
They hadn't been close, but had been in the same class for years, and she was a nice girl.
"It said that all the victims were taken to the military hospital. I thought I'd just try to see if you were still here. It said that many people are. Are you okay?"
Véronique paused, not sure what to answer. Something polite or the truth?
"Yes, I'm okay. I'm going home in 2 weeks."
She didn't say that she'd had 26 surgeries and half her face had been destroyed, and there would be shrapnel in her body forever. But others were worse off, without limbs, and she was alive. The psychiatrists kept stressing that, but she wasn't sure now if having survived was a blessing or a curse.
"Can I come and see you?"
"It's pretty depressing here," Véronique said glumly, not sure if she wanted to see her or not. She'd have to wear the mask. But maybe how Gabriella would react would be a good test of what lay ahead.
"I don't care if it's depressing. I want to see you. I wish I'd known sooner. I've been following you since we moved here. I hated it here at first, but I like it now. I'm working for my father in his art gallery. Will you go back to modelling now when you go home?"
I don't think so. It's too soon." She didn't know what else to say, and Gabriella was afraid to ask her what injuries had kept her in the hospital for 5 months. She hoped she hadn't lost a leg or an arm. The article she'd read said many had, and the bombs had been specially built to do as much damage as possible to human bodies. The same had been true about the attacks in France.
"Can I come?"
She sounded excited about seeing her old classmate. Véronique agreed to see her the following afternoon, and regretted it as soon as she hung up. She wanted to cancel immediately, but forced herself to stick to the plan. She hadn't talked to anyone her own age or seen a friend in 5 months. She didn't want to see any of her modelling friends in Paris. How could she now with the face she was going home with? She had no idea who she was anymore. Everything that defined her had been destroyed. She didn't feel like a person anymore, or a woman, or even a girl. She was a member of the walking wounded, someone to pity or to look away from in horror. She was wearing a hospital dressing gown and pyjamas at the appointed time the next day. She hadn't worn normal clothes since she'd been admitted. Hers had been torn to shreds in the explosion, and no one had replaced them. She didn't need clothes anyway. She couldn't go anywhere. But she realized that she'd need something to wear when she went home. She put the surgical mask in place just before Gabriella came. She brushed her hair back in a ponytail, and the cruel irony was that when she turned her face one way, she looked like herself. And if she turned in the opposite direction, the full horror of her injuries were all one saw. The damage was completely contained on the right side of her face. She adjusted the surgical mask again as she heard a knock on the door, and Gabriella walked in, looked as she had in school, barely older, in a pretty navy blue summer dress with a white collar. She smiled as soon as she saw Véronique and walked toward her.
"Can I hug you? Will I hurt anything?"
she asked her, and Véronique smiled. No, I'm fine. I'm full of shrapnel still, but it's better, and hugging won't hurt me. Gabriella hugged her gingerly as Véronique realized that no one had hugged her or touched her affectionately in 5 months. The tenderness of it brought tears to her eyes. She saw then that Gabby had brought her a small bouquet of pink roses. They sat down in the room's only 2 chairs.
Do you want to go out to the garden? She offered.
Whatever you want,
Gabriella said gently. She thought her old friend's eyes looked tired and said,
Do you have to wear the mask?
It's so I don't get exposed to infection, she said, looking distracted. Gabriella could only imagine what she'd been through after reading the article about the explosion and the havoc it wrought on the victims.
The whole thing is so awful. It makes you afraid to go anywhere. I knew 2 people at the metro station, but they managed to come out unharmed. I had a friend at the Bataclan in Paris in November. He lost an arm, but at least he survived.
She guessed that all of Véronique's injuries must have been internal, since she didn't appear to be missing any limbs. But she could see scars on her arms from the hundreds of lacerations she'd had from the flying bits of metal and glass. It looked to her like Véronique had been lucky. They took a walk in the garden, sat in the shade for a while, and walked back to Véronique's room. It was a nice visit, and Véronique enjoyed it, although it was odd talking to her through the mask. She felt smothered by it, and dishonest somehow, as though she was pretending to be someone else now, the old Véronique instead of the one she had become. She hated the pretense of it, as though she still looked like she used to. But in fact, nothing was the same now. She felt like a different person. I feel stupid wearing the mask, she said in a soft voice to Gabriella.
If it's dangerous for you to be exposed to people's germs, then you're smart to wear it. You don't want to get sick now.
It's not that. And I'm not sick.
With a trembling hand and a simple gesture, she unhooked the paper mask from her right ear and took it off, as Gabriella stared at her with a full view of both halves of her face, the old and the new. Her eyes grew wide as she saw the scars on the right side, burst into tears, and couldn't stop crying. What she saw was so devastating and so upsetting. She had been totally unprepared for what Véronique had gone through and the damage the bomb had done.
Oh, Véro, I'm so sorry. Oh my God, how could they do that to you?
Véronique was crying too, and they sat talking and holding hands. But Gabriella's reaction was what she had needed to know. How could she possibly let anyone see the face she had now? The answer was that she couldn't. No one would be able to tolerate it.
I suppose I was lucky. Some people lost arms and legs, or both. It's only my face.
She tried to minimize it in her own mind, too, but she couldn't. The challenge she was facing was huge, and Gabriella had confirmed it.
You are so beautiful,
she said almost enviously, and then caught herself.
You still are. Will it get better?
She asked in a hushed voice.
A little, not much.
They can do more surgeries to smooth down the scars, but they said they won't go away completely. The scars are too deep. They want to let it heal for a few months. I might see a doctor in Paris, but they've done all they can for now. They told me to wear the mask, but I hate it. You're the only person I've seen till now, except for the doctors and nurses, and my mother's law partner, but he didn't see me without the bandages. If I don't wear the mask, I'll frighten children on the street, Véronique said sadly.
No, you won't. I just wasn't prepared when you took it off. I was guessing that all your injuries were internal since I didn't see any missing limbs.
It sliced a piece off my liver, but apparently that grows back, Véronique said. I'll just have to get used to it. It's kind of hideously ironic, since I've made a living from being beautiful for 4 years. So I'm out of work now, too.
What will you do?
Gabriella asked, worried for her. There were girls she knew who would have committed suicide with a face as badly scarred as Véronique's.
She hoped Véronique wouldn't be one of them. But she had never been particularly vain in school. She was just incredibly beautiful. This was going to be a huge change for her, and a lot to deal with. I thought of wearing a burqa, but I'd feel stupid and dishonest doing that too. I guess it's the surgical mask or nothing. I think people will be afraid to hire me for a normal job. I'd frighten the clients. She felt like a leper and a pariah as she said it, but Gabriella knew it was true. And I don't know how to do anything except pose for the camera.
Maybe you could be a photographer, Gabriella suggested.
Maybe. I hadn't thought of it. I've just been kind of surviving from day to day between surgeries. I haven't thought past this until now, and it would be so weird going home to an empty house without my mother. I'm going to move into her apartment. It would be like crawling back into the womb for her, which she needed now, but painful without Marie-Hélène providing the womb.
Stay in touch, Féro, Gabriella said when she left. I never get to Paris anymore, but if I do, I'll call. And you can always call me if you need to talk. You must have a million friends.
She had followed her old classmate's jet-set life for years, and they were light years apart now. I don't know. I'm not friendly with that many models. I was working all the time. The boy I was dating was with us, just by a weird coincidence. He was killed too. Mentioning him reminded Véronique of something she had wanted to do and hadn't been able to face yet. Gabriella had opened a door that afternoon, and Véronique realized that she couldn't hide from the real world forever. Gabriella stood up to go, and Véronique walked her to the door without her mask. They hugged again at the door, and she thanked Gabriella for the visit and the flowers, and Gabriella turned in the doorway.
"I'm sorry I reacted the way I did when I saw your face. I was so sorry for you. I'm just glad you're alive. That's all that matters."
Is it? I keep asking myself that. What matters now? How I look or what I do or who I am? I'm not sure who I am anymore. I'm not the same person I was 6 months ago, inside or out.
No one would be, Gabriella said. You'll figure it out.
But they both knew it wouldn't be easy. Finding herself now and a new path in life would be harder than 26 surgeries and surviving the bomb. She had to find her way now, and she had no idea how to do it. Gabriella's reaction to seeing her scarred face had told her all she needed to know about how people would react to her. One thing was sure. She wasn't beautiful anymore. That was all she had been before. Now she would have to be more. But what? And how? She had absolutely no idea. Chapter 5. After Gabriella's visit, Véronique asked the nurse for some paper and an envelope. She had a letter to write that was long overdue. Gabriella had been an emissary from a broader world, beyond the hospital, surgeries, and medications. Véronique was going home soon and beginning to think about the world she had left behind and almost forgotten for the past nearly 6 months. Cyril had been part of that forgotten life, although she hadn't forgotten him. She wrote a letter to his mother that night and couldn't stop crying while she wrote it. There was so much to say, but she didn't know his parents well and had only met them once. As an only child, she could only imagine how immense their loss was. She told his mother how sorry she was and what a lovely young man he had been. She offered them heartfelt sympathy and apologized for not writing to them sooner. She said only that it had been a difficult time for her and didn't offer 26 surgeries as a valid excuse. At least she was alive. But he wasn't. She didn't expect a response, but she felt relieved after she wrote it, sealed the envelope, and asked the nurse if she would mail it for her. She remembered his address by heart and felt a wave of survivor guilt wash over her again that night. He had only gone to the check-in counter with her to help her and her mother and had been there at just the wrong moment, as they all were. He had been standing next to her mother helping her with her bag, while Véronique was only a few feet away, the few feet that had made a life and death difference. She had no idea why she had survived and they hadn't, other than the random hand of fate. The next morning, Véronique took another step into real life. Bernard had left her some cash in case she needed it, which she hadn't so far. She asked one of the younger nurses to buy some clothes for her, some jeans and a sweater, and a pair of sneakers. She had no clothes to go home in. She asked for a bag for her toiletries and a purse of some kind. She hadn't thought about clothes to wear for months and lived in hospital gowns and pyjamas with paper slippers. At Véronique's request, Bernard had had her mother's secretary empty her apartment in the 7th, put the furniture in storage, and send everything else in boxes to her mother's apartment. Her apartment was for sale, and everything she owned was now at her mother's. She would have to go through all of it, and her mother's clothes and papers, when she went home. At least it would give her something to do for a while. Dr. Verbier, her main psychiatrist, questioned her about it that afternoon. With her release from the hospital weeks away, the sessions had gotten more intense about her plans. Who was she going to see? Where she would live? If she had contacted any friends? How she was going to occupy her time? "How do you feel about going to live in your mother's apartment?" the doctor asked her. "It's what I want to do," Véronique said quietly. She didn't want to have to justify it. "I grew up there. I'm selling my apartment. It's on the market now." She wasn't attached to it, and had no need for it anymore. "It will be hard for you, Véronique, being in the place where your mother lived without her now." "I own the apartment," Véronique said, eager to get off the subject. "It will be filled with memories and all of her belongings." She knew it would be hard, but it would be comforting too. A part of her fantasized that her mother would be there when she got home. It was still hard to believe that she wouldn't be. She still had her mother's memorial service and burial to arrange. Bernard was keeping her mother's ashes for her in the office safe. "Have you thought about what you're going to do when you get home for work?" Dr. Verbier asked her. She was embarrassed to admit that, thanks to her mother and her own earnings set aside, she had the luxury of not working for a while. The doctor was well aware that she had been a highly successful model and would have to choose a new career now. Véronique had nothing but change to adjust to when she got home. No part of her previous life was still intact. All of the psychiatric staff had discussed her case and were concerned that she could be a suicide risk. But Dr. Verbier was fairly sure she wasn't. But there was no question in her mind. Véronique's re-entry after the hospital would be a tremendous adjustment, and she was liable to have a hard time with it. She had to find a whole new direction for her life. Véronique was tired of talking to them about it. She felt ready to go home, no matter how challenging it was. She had another project she wanted to pursue, and asked Bernard to send her a laptop so she could start even before she left the hospital. She started working on it as soon as the laptop arrived. She wanted to research her father and read everything about him. She wanted to see what kind of man he was. She found all the information about him that she wanted and discovered that he had retired in June, shortly after he lost his wife. Marie-Hélène had died in March, and Florence Hayes a month later. Bill Hayes was retired now. He had given up his Senate seat due to ill health, one report said. She read everything she could about him, from his voting record to the failed presidential campaign many years earlier when he had been the vice presidential candidate. She thought about how strange it would have been if her father had been president of the United States, but his political ambitions seemed to have cooled a little after they lost the election. He won his Senate seat then and had had a highly respected career. She couldn't help wondering if he had ever regretted letting Marie-Hélène get away, if his senatorial career had been worth losing the woman he loved, and who had loved him so deeply. He looked handsome in the photographs she saw on the internet. There were several of them with his wife and children during his campaigns, and she felt sorry for her mother again when she saw them. She wondered if her mother had followed him online, or if it would have been too painful to do so. She wasn't a woman who cried about the past. She had always been energetic, optimistic, and forward-thinking, and had never expressed any regrets to her daughter, even in her final letter. Véronique spent hours reading about her father, and found a mailing address for him in New York. She had no idea if he would ever see the letter if she wrote to him, but she wanted to try. She spent 2 days composing the letter, determined not to be indiscreet or to cause any problems. She addressed him as Senator Hayes, and regretfully informed him that Marie-Hélène Vincent had passed away in the bombing of the Brussels airport. She introduced herself as Marie-Hélène's daughter, and respectfully asked if a conversation with him would be possible, by email or by phone, and supplied her email address and her mother's home phone number, which she assumed he knew anyway, since Marie-Hélène had already been living there when they met, and they had been in contact from time to time in the years since, according to the letter she had left. Véronique read the letter several times, combing it for any overly personal references or anything he might find offensive. It was a letter that even a secretary could have read. She wondered if he'd ever see it, or if he would welcome contact with her, but she knew she had to try, for her own sake and her mother's. Her mother had finally disclosed who her father was, and Véronique had the feeling that she had opened that door so that Véronique could contact him if she wished, once her mother was gone. She sealed the letter carefully and asked one of the nurses to mail it for her. She had included the date that she would be returning to Paris and said that she had been at the airport with her mother, without providing any details of the injuries she had sustained herself. She didn't want his pity, but she wanted a better sense of who he was. Her mother had referred to him as remarkable and extraordinary and said he was a wonderful man. Véronique wanted to know if it was true, and how he could have left them out of his life for so long. She guessed that his 3 children were at least 20 years older than she was, and she could easily have been his grandchild when she was born, and he could have been her mother's father. She spent her final days in the hospital doing practical things to prepare for when she got home. She bought a cell phone and reactivated her old number. She turned it on a few times, but there were no messages, and it never rang. Since she was no longer modelling or active at her agency, it appeared as though everyone had forgotten her, which seemed just as well now. There was no longer any question of her modelling again. She was one of those tragic stories people would tell one day of the supermodel who had been blown up in a terrorist attack and never returned. The photographs of her would surface again now and then as one of the biggest models of her day, with a brief career that lasted only a few years. She wore the surgical mask when she went to buy her cell phone, and the salesman looked at her questioningly, but didn't comment. She felt like one of those neurotic women who were germophobes, but better that than the truth, that half of her face looked like something out of a horror movie. The doctors assured her that the brightness of the worst scars on her face would fade somewhat with time, but for the moment, after her most recent surgery, the scars were still very vivid. She tried not to look at herself in the mirror when she brushed her teeth or combed her hair, but her eyes always travelled there and she stared at her face, as though hoping that, by magic, it would have radically improved, or the scars be gone. She still found it hard to believe that she would look like that forever, but it was equally hard to believe that she would never see her mother again. Bernard called a few days before she was due to leave the hospital to make sure she was all right, and asked how she was getting home. He had offered to accompany her, although she knew he was very busy, and she had told him she preferred to make the trip alone. 2 days before she left, she had an answer from Cyril's mother. It was measured and polite, and expressed her condolences for the loss of Véronique's mother, but the letter wasn't warm. Reading between the lines, she had the feeling that Lady Buxton blamed her for Cyril's untimely death. If he hadn't been with her, he wouldn't have been in Brussels or anywhere near the attack. She said that his death had been a terrible shock for them, and an immeasurable loss. She expressed the hope that Véronique had recovered from her injuries. Everything about the letter was an example of good manners and good breeding, but there was nothing affectionate, or even barely compassionate in it for the last woman in their son's life.
She was sure that his mother had asked herself the same question she had asked herself 1,000 times. Why had she survived and he hadn't? He didn't deserve to die any more than any of the others, nor did she deserve the appalling injuries she had sustained. She had been to hell and back in the last 6 months, and still had a long way to go to recover from the trauma. All of her psychiatrists had reservations about her going home, particularly with no one to go home to, and no family to support her through the inevitable difficulties she would face. But medically, there was no longer any reason to keep her in the hospital, which was depressing for her too. Their overall decision was that she needed to get back into a more active life, to the degree she was able. She would have to return for further surgeries to effect some slight improvement to the scars on her face. There was still the potential risk that the shifting of any of the shrapnel still in her body could cause a life-threatening situation. But there was no way to predict that. They had done very little cosmetic work on the extensive scarring on her body, but Véronique had opted not to. She could always deal with that later, if she wanted to. The wounds were still very fresh. For now, she preferred to wear long-sleeve shirts and sweaters and trousers to conceal the scars on her body, rather than undergo additional surgeries. She said it didn't matter to her. She wasn't modelling anymore, and beauty was no longer a professional necessity, or of importance to her. The only scars that mattered to her were those on her face, so that she wouldn't be so shockingly disfigured. But they were the ones they were the least able to improve. They had done their very best, but even they were disappointed by the results. The unmarked half of her face served as a cruel reminder to them, as well as Véronique, of how perfect and flawless her face had been before. She made a point of visiting the other victims she had met in the hospital before she left, although she hadn't gotten to know many of them very well. Most of them were too ill and damaged to leave their rooms, even 6 months after the explosion. She saw some of them occasionally in wheelchairs in the garden, missing limbs and accompanied by nurses. And for many months she hadn't been well enough to leave her room either, after her constant surgeries. They wished her luck when she said goodbye to them. She gave a box of chocolates to the young woman in the room next to her who had lost both arms and a foot, and had three young children who were being cared for by her mother, waiting for her at home. Her husband had died in the blast of the bomb. It reminded Véronique again that in many ways she had been lucky, and even without working she was financially able to take care of herself. Many of the victims were in dire financial straits since they weren't able to work, and government payments for the wounded had not kicked in yet. Victims of the attack in Paris 4 months earlier than the one in Brussels were still waiting for government funds too. The machinery of government did not move quickly. In many ways, Véronique was better off than her fellow victims. The nurses gave her a cake and a little party the night before she left, and she thanked them for all the help they had given her. They were happy for her that she was leaving, and they said they were going to miss her. After she went back to her room, one of the nurses said to another, "I used to look at her in magazines and envy her. She was so beautiful. And now I wonder what will happen to her." "She'll be all right," the older nurse reassured her. "She's young. She'll come through it." But they both knew that wasn't always true. Victims of catastrophic events like the one she had lived through often committed suicide, unable to adjust to the changes they had to face. At least Véronique had shown no sign of suicidal tendencies so far. She had told them she'd be back for further surgeries. She intended to come back to the doctors she knew and didn't want to try and find new ones in Paris. She didn't know anyone to recommend them to her and didn't want to ask, and she had had enough medical attention to last a lifetime. She had no complaints about the treatment she'd had at the military hospital, but couldn't bear the thought of more operations. She lay awake in bed that night, and only slept a few hours. She was torn about going home, both terrified and jubilant. In her heart of hearts, she still magically believed that her mother would be there to greet her and tell her it was all a big mistake,
She hadn't died and had been waiting for her in Paris all along. She knew that wasn't going to happen, but she kept hoping anyway. She left quietly the next morning, with the nurses waving as she got into a taxi to take her to the train station. She had a small tote bag with her toiletries and her computer in it, some underwear they had given her at the hospital. She was wearing the clothes the nurse had bought for her, a pair of jeans and a grey sweater, a pair of navy blue sneakers, and she wore the surgical mask for the trip home. She felt as though she was returning to Paris as a stranger, not herself. She bought her ticket for the TGV high-speed train to Paris and watched the countryside rush past as she sat rigid in her seat, suddenly terrified that there would be an explosion on the train. She was shaking, and she could easily imagine it happening. Images of the Zaventem attack kept flashing through her mind. There were beads of sweat on her face by the time the train slid into the station. She rushed from the train and took great gulps of air to calm down the moment she got outside. Having survived the trip, it felt wonderful to be back in Paris. She hailed a cab, and on the drive to the 17th arrondissement, she saw all the familiar landmarks and nearly cried. She had thought she would never see her home again. So many times she had thought she would die in the hospital, and wished she had. She sat staring at her building when the cab stopped in front of it, and didn't get out for a minute. "Is this the right address?" the driver asked her, and she nodded. He was puzzled by why she didn't get out. Most of his passengers were in a hurry. This one wasn't. She seemed to hesitate, as though she wasn't sure what to do next and was in a foreign land. She was savouring the moment, and at the same time, dreading having to enter the empty apartment. Bernard had sent her a set of keys that Marie-Hélène kept at the office for emergencies, since all of their keys had been lost at the airport. She held them now in a shaking hand, paid the driver, and finally got out. She entered the numbers for the outer door code, pushed the heavy iron doors open, and walked inside. She used an electronic badge for a second door and slowly walked up the stairs to her mother's apartment on the second floor. The building was silent and empty at that time of day. There was a guardian who must have been having lunch. Véronique slowly unlocked the front door with shaking hands and turned off the alarm in the unlit entrance hall and looked around. Everything was as her mother had left it. There was a navy blue wool jacket sitting on a chair, an umbrella in a stand. All the familiar antiques that Marie-Hélène had inherited from her parents and Véronique had grown up with. The woman who came to clean had kept the apartment dusted and in good order. There was a stack of mail, which Bernard's secretary came to pick up every week and went through, paying bills, opening correspondence, and throwing junk mail away. The door to her mother's little study was open, and there was no sign of activity. She could see the living room with all the familiar furniture. The shades were drawn throughout the apartment. It all had a dry, brittle feeling to it, like a fallen leaf. The dining room was empty, and her own girlhood bedroom was down a hallway next to her mother's, with the kitchen at the end of the apartment. It was all there, but there was no sign of her mother, just as she had feared, and she had never felt so alone in her life. She sat down on a chair in the entrance hall. Her legs were shaking hard, and she started to cry like the abandoned child she felt like. She pulled off the surgical mask, and her tears flooded her face and drenched her scars. She cried until she had no more tears to shed and walked down the hall to her mother's bedroom. The bed was made, and her slippers were underneath the night table. They were pink satin with a little ball of fluff on them. Véronique had bought them for her for Mother's Day the year before. It seemed like a lifetime ago. She walked into her mother's small dressing room and saw all her clothes hanging there, all the familiar things she had seen her mother wear, her business suits, her casual clothes for weekends, her favourite sweaters, the black velvet dress she wore on Christmas every year. It took Véronique's breath away. and when she walked into her own room, it was piled high with boxes, all the things that had been sent from her apartment. It was all here. She had come home again. But her mother was gone forever. She knew that now. Her fantasy hadn't happened. Her mother wasn't waiting for her. Her footsteps echoed in the empty apartment as she walked into the kitchen. She had no idea how she was going to survive living here without her mother. But she had to. She caught a glimpse of herself in a mirror in the hallway when she went back to her bedroom, and she saw the truth boldly staring at her. Who she was now. She was no longer the girl people would stare at when she walked down the street because she was so beautiful, or whom they recognized because they had seen her in 100 magazines. She was a stranger, even to herself. Half of her face was a reminder of those easy, happy days, and the other half was her reality of her present and her future. She was the girl who had survived a massive explosion and had deep, ugly scars to show for it. She would have to live with their shocked faces in future, and the jumbled memories of the worst day of her life when she had lost her mother. Losing her beauty was the least part of it, and she would gladly have traded that if her mother had survived. But she hadn't. And in her wounded heart and soul, Véronique hadn't survived it either.